was still there.
Yeah, it kind of comes through because it's a not a very good tape machine.
Yeah, so we pop over the background of techno music.
Yeah, that's kind of neat. All right. Matt Bullock's talking today about how frogs get their worms, understanding amphibian helminth life cycle strategies from a community perspective.
Okay.
And what's the date?
What's the date? Today is the 19th of October.
2006.
Okay, so I kind of lost track of who was speaking and realized yesterday that I had to give this seminar and kind of scramble around thinking about some of the things we were initially talking about. And if I remember right, one of them was discussing some crazy parasite and why it would be important to study it. And this last summer, I was fortunate to teach natural history of invertebrates at Cedar Point, and we played around with a kind of odd tapeworm called Dystochymetra bufanus, and I thought I would talk about that, although I didn't have enough stuff, I think, to talk about it, so I thought I would approach this by kind of giving you guys a background, which most of you heard before, about some of the work we've been doing on life cycles of parasites of amphibians and helminths predominantly, and how those relate to what kind of patterns we see, and then stick in there this tapeworm stuff we just started. So when you look at the amphibian helminths, predominantly there's two groups of parasites. There are trematodes, and these have aquatic life cycles, okay? And most of us in here have heard of trematodes, and we know that they, as adults, live in some kind of vertebrate host, in this case, frogs. And these are my favorite animals in the world. And they release eggs into an aquatic habitat, usually when they defecate. These are ingested by snails, and here they reproduce asexually and release those free-swimming stages called cercaria. And then these swim around and usually insist, as a metasecaria stage, in some kind of second intermediate host. A lot of times it's arthropods, sometimes it's other amphibians. And then when a frog ingests one of these second intermediate hosts, it becomes infected, kind of continuing the life cycle. Now, just to kind of show you some of this stuff, this is the eggs which are released in the frog feces. This is a frog lung fluke, since that's what I spent the last 6 years working on my PhD. And they have a little myrcidium that's already developed in there. Those guys are ingested by snails, and these are predominantly aquatic snails for most trematode species. And then inside of the snail, those eggs hatch, and you can see a little operculum on a trematode egg there, and then that little myrcidium will swim out and actually penetrate the gut of that snail and then develop. Okay, and they develop into a sporocyst in this particular species, so you have these sac-like structures with germ balls in there, and they form cercaria. Okay, and then these cercaria emerge out of those snails, depending on the species, around 30 days or so. Okay, and they'll release these things over and over for up to probably about 2-3 weeks, and even probably the length of the life of the snail if they don't kill them. And this is one of a cercaria, and I just put a little movie in here. The point is that these guys are mobile and they swim. They're free swimming stages. Okay, so this is kind of your generic trematode life cycle. But there's lots of variation in the second intermediate host usage, okay, and how these little trematodes actually get into them. So in some frog lung flukes, okay, which is a family of trematodes that live in the lungs of frogs, they predominantly use dragonflies specifically as the second intermediate host. And dragonflies are kind of interesting animals that, as larvae or juveniles, they live in aquatic habitat, and they have this little structure called a branchial basket, okay? And they have their gills in there, and they suck water back and forth. And the way these dragonflies become infected is, this is a, it ain't going to work for some strange reason. But this was a movie of the posterior end or the abdomen of a dragonfly, and he was sucking in water, and you could actually see some of these cercaria actually going in there. Okay, and they can't actually penetrate into these guys. They have to get sucked in to infect them. And eventually what happens is they form these metasecaria. They lose their tails, and usually within 4 days you see these structures in there. Okay. Some frog lung flukes actually can penetrate inside of the second intermediate host. And this is a damselfly. This is actually working. And you see all of these little cercaria swimming around it. Okay. And damselflies don't have that rectal breathing apparatus. So if you watch this damselfly, it kind of sits there for a while. As these cercaria are put in there, they're swimming around it. And all of a sudden, it starts not liking what's happening around it. It kind of starts wiggling around, and all of a sudden, that damselfly, as you'll see in a second, will start scratching and thrashing around. Okay. And one of the reasons for
it. Just Discovery Channel stuff.
One of the reasons for that is that those cercaria, when they encounter that damselfly, they actually stick onto it with their little ventral sucker, and you can watch them actually crawl up with those suckers. And once they find a little space in between the joints, they actually start penetrating and they lose their tails. Okay? And because of this behavior by these cercaria of these particular species, they can infect any region of the body of aquatic arthropods. So you can find them in these prolegs of midges and anal gills and the body cavity and the legs of little hyalella crustaceans and so on. Okay. Some cercaria, like bladder flukes, actually get eaten by the second intermediate host. Okay, and bladder flukes are a little different, that they don't use snails, they actually use fingernail clams as the first intermediate host. This is a clam, and these things wiggling around are cercaria. And the one thing I should say is that frog bladder fluke cercaria are relatively large, okay, for cercaria. They're usually, you know, they could get up to maybe 3-4, maybe even 5 in some species, millimeters in size. So they're big. And people have a lot of times thought that they imitate little aquatic leagokeets or something like that in the environment. This little movie shows a damselfly there. And I'm moving one of these cercaria towards it with a little probe. And if you watch it, as soon as I place it in front of it, that little damselfly just ingests that immediately. Okay. And I had to modify this a little bit so you could see it. But it basically eats that thing, and a few days later, when you open that damselfly up, you find a nice little gorgonderid or bladder fluke metasecaria inside of it, okay, and cystid. Well, so there's lots of variation, okay, in the way these things get into a second intermediate host. The other group of helminths and amphibians are nematodes, okay, and these predominantly are considered to have terrestrial life cycles, okay, so this is your frog or toad, these guys are living in their intestines or lungs and so on, they mate and they release eggs in the frog's feces, they develop, they hatch, and then they penetrate, okay, and then develop in that amphibian host. And this is just showing you a little movie of an egg that was recovered from frog's feces, and there's a developed juvenile in there, and it's trying to get out. And you can't really see the egg membrane, but you can kind of tell that the worm is pushing against it. Okay. And eventually it just breaks out, okay, and crawls out of that egg. And basically starts developing in the soil or in the feces. Okay, they eat and they molt a number of times, usually depending on the species, 3 times. Okay, and then they do this kind of interesting behavior. They crawl around, and this is just in a petri dish. They crawl around, but they try to get on surfaces of things. And you can see that one going into a pile of frog poop. there's another one crawling around. And eventually, when they get on that frog feces, they sit on the surface, okay? And they just kind of wiggle around.
This is the kind of stuff we always read about. We don't get to actually see it.
I
this
know.
Is great.
I like always trying to figure out if this stuff actually happens in the real world, right? And so that's what they do. And then when they encounter a host, they get onto that host and they either crawl into it or penetrate or crawl on top of it. And interestingly enough, when you look at percentages of these adult trematodes, which are aquatic, and nematodes, which are terrestrial, and different amphibian species that live in different habitats, you see these kind of nice patterns. So aquatic frogs, for example, have predominantly aquatic trematodes. Okay? Semi-terrestrial frogs have a little bit more of these nematodes, less trematodes. And terrestrial amphibians, such as toads, are almost always loaded with just nematodes. They don't encounter trematodes very much. And then these other things like semi-arboreal and arboreal that live in trees or on grass, it varies depending how much time they spend in the water or on land and what they can pick up, assuming that none of these things are very host-specific. Well, the nematodes we're talking about, they really belong to three species, and depending where you go in the world, three genera. Okay, Cosmocercoides, Oswaldocruzia, and Rhabdius, where there's a number of species that live in the lungs. Okay, and these guys really belong to the three main orders of the five orders, or whatever the way you classify nematodes now, of the Phasmidium. Okay, so there's an Ascarid, Trichostrangial, and a Rhabditid nematode. Okay, and interestingly enough, all of these guys do that same kind of life cycle strategy, where they hatch in the egg and they crawl out on the surface and are ready to infect. There's a little bit of differences among these species in how long those infective juveniles live. For example, Cosmocercoides, they could actually live for 3 months and still be infective if they're in the right environment. Oswaldocruzia, about 3 to 4 weeks. Rhabdius, Gabe could probably tell us a lot better, but you know they're around 4 weeks or so, some of them, at least in the amphibian ones that you find in the literature. And because of that, in terrestrial amphibians, they're really successful. So here's some data I had from my master's for the mean abundances, or at least number of nematodes per all the toads examined. So like the Ascarid, you know, 30 worms per toad, the Trichostrangial about 10, and the Rhabdius around 18 or so. So they're relatively successful, okay? You find large numbers of them compared to other amphibian parasites. Now, I should say that most of this kind of work on amphibian helminth communities was done predominantly in the eastern part of the U.S., okay, and a little bit out here in California. And this map just shows you the average annual precipitation, okay, of water, right, in the U.S. And you can see there's this nice gradient where the eastern part of the U.S. is relatively moist. Right, the western part of the U.S., except for this coast right here, is relatively dry. And Nebraska is kind of a great place because it's smack in the middle of the U.S., okay, and it has this nice gradient, okay. And UNL is located in the eastern part where it's relatively moist, okay. Still relatively dry, but compared to other places in Nebraska, while our field station, Cedar Point, is located in the western part of the Nebraska, where it's relatively dry. Okay, so one thing I thought when I initially came here that all amphibian helminth communities were going to look the same, and when I went out and started collecting, all of a sudden my whole world was, you know, torn apart and said, this is not the way life works in Nebraska. And so we spent number of years now trying to figure out why that happens. And so we went out to eastern Nebraska, and this is Pawnee Lake right out here in Lancaster County, and went out and collected, you know, six species of amphibians of different sizes, habitats, and so forth, and looked at their parasites, okay?
And when you do this kind of stuff, this is what you see. It's the same, similar type of pattern. You know, aquatic things like bullfrogs are going to have lots of trematodes. Semi-terrestrial things like plains leopard frogs are going to have a little bit more nematodes. And then terrestrial toads, you know, they don't come in contact with those nematodes very often, or excuse me, trematodes. So they have nematodes predominantly that you find in them. And these other ones are going to vary, you know, depending where they spend their time. Well, although this kind of shows, you know, it looks about the same when we actually looked at the abundances of these nematodes in, let's say, terrestrial toads, we're relatively shocked, right? This is what you see of those same species, okay? Very few of those toads were infected. In fact, I think only one with Cosmos rhacoides, maybe one or two with Oswaldo crusia, and maybe 10 or so with Arabdius, okay? Well, this was kind of odd. And so what we decided to do was actually do some experimental infections. Okay, this was a different toad species than in Wisconsin. Maybe these things are bad hosts. Okay, so we're going to try two nematodes here, Cosmos rhacoides, Oswaldo crusia, and then we have some field data for this Arabdius, and actually Gabe is working on his PhD on these guys, another Arabdius species, so hopefully soon he'll have some interesting data to conflict this, or at least have some things to discuss. And so how do we do this? Well, we would collect our nematodes from places where they were common in toads. Pull them out, you let them release eggs and water. These guys hatch, and they develop, and you allow them to molt. Okay. And they're relatively nice to be able to tell apart, because when you look at the J3s among these three different groups, you can tell them apart real easily in the infective stage by looking at the shape of that tail. Okay. And these are just some of the descriptions, and these are some pictures we took when we were doing this kind of stuff. Okay. So how do we actually do these infections? Well, when we do experimental infections, you either raise amphibians or sometimes this is extremely time-demanding, so you go find populations where supposedly they're uninfected, and you collect these guys and you divide them into three groups. Time zero control, which you usually dissect immediately to see if these guys are infected or not. If they're not, then you continue. Experimental control, which you'll expose, and then you keep a same sample size of as a time T control. And basically when you necropsy your experimentals, you necropsy these guys to see if they're still uninfected in case you miss something. Well, how do we know our nematodes are actually viable? Well, when we do these things, we place them, the amphibians in with about 50 J3s, and you leave them in there for about 24 hours. And then you put them in their cages and you wait for, in some species, 30 days, and some species only about 18 days before they become adults. Well, in order to know that those juveniles are infective, we usually run some kind of positive control. Okay, so we always expose a group of amphibians that we know that nematode goes into. Okay. And at the same time, we expose another amphibian species that we don't know if these things actually can go into or not. And that way, if these guys get infected in the experimental group and these ones don't, we can at least have better evidence that maybe there's some host specificity going on. Okay. All right, so we did this initially last semester, and I actually have about 60 amphibians in my apartment that I have to dissect tonight, right after the seminar. And we expose, you know, anywhere from 5 to 10 individuals of each one of these species, plus having all those time zero and time T controls. And when you do this with Cosmos rhacoides variabilis, 5 of these species became infected. Bullfrogs did not. Okay? When you actually look at the prevalence, okay, these toads and these arboreal tree frogs were wonderful hosts. Every single one of them got infected. They had higher mean abundances, which I'm not going to show you here. The worms were mature and more developed, at least, than some of these other hosts. Okay.
But when we look at the field data from the same site, we see a reverse thing, where these arboreal tree frogs and toads are the lowest infected. Okay. Which kind of doesn't make sense since they're the best hosts in the laboratory. And in fact, even bullfrogs were infected, and some of these semi-terrestrial leopard frogs were relatively higher infected than these, what are supposed to be really decent hosts in the lab. Well, one of the things we observed over the last few years collecting and killing all these poor frogs and toads out there is that both leopard frogs and bullfrogs commonly eat other small anurans out there, so chorus frogs. Okay. And so we decided to try this little experiment. We know this because you bring these guys in, that's the stomach of a leopard frog, you open them up and there's a semi-digested chorus frog. Okay. So we decided to do this little experiment where we actually took chorus frogs, uninfected ones, and put 10 adult Cosmos recordis variabilis inside of those. Okay. And then we fed them to leopard frogs and we fed them to toads. Okay, to see what would happen, if these worms would survive. And surprisingly, what we found is that these guys actually survived in the leopard frogs for up to about 6-7 days, and then they pooped them out. Okay? While all the toads, or at least the two or three we did, kept all or most of those worms inside of them. Okay? So it suggests that even though these leopard frogs get infected in nature, some of them get infected naturally, probably by these guys penetrating. Sometimes they may pick them up for a little while by, you know, ingesting a frog with these things. They don't seem to be very good hosts compared to toads. And, you know, so we think that probably some of these semi-arboreal species out at this location are the predominant hosts that keep these guys. And here, this may not be true prevalence of infection. Some of this may be actually skewed because these guys are eating other frogs that are infected out there and keeping these worms for a short period and then losing them. Well, so one of the questions that comes out, what about these other nematodes? So this is the Cosmos recordis variabilis. We tried the same thing with Oswaldo cruzia pipins with the same numbers approximately. And in fact, we got all of these frogs infected, okay? Although they never became mature in these smaller ones, although that may have been for maybe not feeding these frogs as much as I should have. They're relatively small and they don't want to eat bigger crickets sometimes. And the field data, at least from the Rhabdias, shows that all of these species can get infected, although all the laboratory work suggests and that toads and these tree frogs are really good, better hosts than all of these other ones. And this is some of Gabe's work. He's been infecting toads with Rhabdias chicoloquensis, and they, at least what he's telling me, they go into them pretty well. There doesn't seem to be any problems. So one of the questions, you know, that comes up from this is, why are these terrestrial toads in Nebraska not infected in nature where they're such good hosts in the lab? Well, when we look at the abundances of all the nematodes we find in these toads at this location, you see this correlation. It's not very strong, but you notice if you look at the size of these guys, little toads have more worms than some of these adults. Every once in a while you have a bigger toad that has one or two worms, but most of the worms are in these tiny little toads. And so Bufa woodhousii is kind of a nice little toad that we consider terrestrial, but as they metamorphose, they're relatively aquatic. They sit around the edges of the pond. Okay. And afterwards they move out into, you know, the prairie habitat. And in fact, by the end of the summer, when you actually go looking for toads, at least out in other parts of Nebraska, you find a lot of them have this kind of dark muzzle. And one of the reasons for that is that we find them buried in the sand, and that sand gets relatively hot, and they stick out their muzzle, and they actually get sunburned. If you keep them in lab, they'll peel this off in about a week. And we think that once they move out into this relatively dry environment, those nematodes can't develop out there and infect these toads. So when you look at this pond kind of situation and all of these different amphibians and their habitat, even though toads and these arboreal tree frogs are better hosts, those nematodes don't encounter them enough to get into them. So they have to get into these other frogs, which are relatively poorer in being able to be infected.
So, Matt, what'd you do for that picture? Did you like throw a rock in there to make those waves where you were going to...
No, there was actually a kid from Field Parasites standing there, and I had to cover him up with a bullfrog.
That's huge.
Yeah. I know.
Is that over on the road?
Yeah, by Cedar Point, actually. All right, so then we went out to western Nebraska. I think we won't get to the tapeworm, but that's okay. We went out to western Nebraska, and again, we went out and collected about 6 species of frogs, although some of them were different species. They had about the same ecological habitat, okay? And some things like, you know, spadefoot toads and coarse frogs out there, we didn't get very many. But if you look actually at those communities of parasites in them, to our surprise, all of them were dominated, well, maybe not to our surprise, but just to say that, were dominated by trematodes, and these semi-arboreal species had nothing. Okay. And there was predominantly 3 species, 2 lung flukes, Parviplexus and Coloradensis, and this bladder fluke, Golgodorina. From Maine, oh. Actually, one of them, the life cycle was described to me. So I must have been thinking that. Well, the cool thing about those guys is that...
You've been watching the baseball playoffs.
No, I don't watch baseball.
That would cost you a job.
Yeah, if you give that.
Well, I'll change it. I hope so. Okay, so the life cycle of these guys was established in the literature, and in the frog lung flukes, dragonflies were the main hosts. Okay, so your actual frog has to eat either aquatic or terrestrial dragonfly. Bladder flukes, that life cycle was actually worked out in Maine, and they insist in tadpoles, and then a frog has to eat a smaller frog or tadpole. Well, to our surprise, when we actually started looking at all these amphibians, we found that these tiny, tiny little amphibians actually had adult trematodes. So this toad, which is about 10 millimeters, had frog lung flukes and bladder flukes. Obviously, that toad is not eating other frogs or dragonflies. So we said, okay, let's try to figure some of this out. And over the last 6 years, we actually worked out some of these life cycles by doing lab infections and field data and so on. And the first lung fluke killer, Hemidelicus parviplexus, uses dragonflies specifically as second intermediate host. And this has been shown by Scott Snyder and by Kroll and so forth, so we just confirmed it. In terms of the host specificity in the neurons, they infect aquatic bullfrogs, and these leopard frogs are resistant. And in nature, rarely we find them in toads, okay? Although very rarely, because they usually don't feed on dragonflies. Second species, Coloradensis, has been shown to be a generalist, and they can infect any aquatic arthropod based on how those Stracaria actually find them and penetrate. And these guys can't infect these aquatic bullfrogs, but infect some of these semi-terrestrial leopard frogs and terrestrial toads. And the exciting thing is that they infect such a wide range of these little arthropods that we think those tiny toads, you know, feed on small things and can actually get infected that way. Bladder fluke is a little bit more interesting because that life cycle is variable at the second intermediate host. In terms of definitive host, they can go into 4 of these neurons out in western Nebraska. And the reason I say they're variable is that life cycle, again, was done in the East Coast, and they showed, and they have drawings of this stuff, although some of those drawings are difficult to tell what they mean, they form cysts in those tadpoles, and then a bigger frog will be either a froglet or a tadpole. Well, we brought this thing into the lab. When you take Stracaria from a clam, give it to a tadpole, what we found, instead of forming those cysts, there's juvenile little worms that just sit and wait in the kidneys. Okay? As soon as that tadpole metamorphoses, those tiny little frogs and toads actually have those bladder flukes that migrate into the bladder. Well, we also took these cercaria and we gave them to damselflies, and they actually ate them readily. And in fact, when you do this, you find a metasecaria stage. You feed that damselfly to a bigger frog, and sure enough, they get adult ones in the bladder. Other thing we tried is we actually took these naturally infected tadpoles with these worms in the bladder and fed them to bigger lab-raised frogs. And in fact, when you do that, they also get infected. So there's three ways that these things actually move around to their definitive host. And when you look at the population structure of these things, when you look at tadpoles, leopard frogs, lots of them are infected, about 55%. Toads, a little bit less so. Bullfrogs, they never have deformities as tadpoles. Okay. When you look at adult frogs, leopard frogs, again, they have lots. Toads, about the same as tadpoles. But bullfrogs, 90% of them are infected. You know, they have up to 55 worms. And one of the ways we think they're getting them is by eating damselflies and other frogs. Okay. So what does all of this stuff mean? There's all this variation and so on. Well, part of the stuff I was doing for my PhD, we tried to make a phylogeny by getting some worms, sequencing some genes, the complete ITS region, and getting some worms from gene bank and actually aligning these things and see if there's any patterns. And this is just one of the six most parsimonious trees, or this is, I guess, the strict consensus tree. And the only reason I'm showing you this, there's 23 different individuals of frog lung flukes. Most of the bootstrap values were relatively strong, except for this clade right here. Okay, it was about 68. And if you just look at the individual species, what you see is that there was three main clades. Okay, and there was European and North American species in two of these. Okay, so suggesting that these trematodes have a, you know, ancient history and they evolved probably before the breakup of, or at least our ancestors before the breakup of Pangaea. When we actually look at the life cycle stuff, when we see that the two basal European species only use damselflies, okay? Next species, this North American frog lung fluke, uses both damselflies and brachyflies. The next group is a specialist, and these guys are all North American, and they only use dragonflies. Okay, while this last clade, at least the three that we know the life cycles of, they are all generalists. Okay. When you look at some of the life cycle stages, there's also some patterns. These basal ones have metasecaria that are never encysted for whatever reason, and then all these other ones have encysted metasecaria. And so something must have happened in their evolutionary past that actually selected, you know, for a generalist or specialist, and then these guys that were basal down here. And, you know, this is relatively hard to figure out what exactly happened when we actually tried some host infections, at least with the North American species of different related frogs and toads. And when you do this kind of stuff, it's really messy. So these are six different species of amphibians. There's two leopard frogs, which are from the same clade, two bullfrogs or green frog, bullfrog from the same clade, a wood frog, and a toad, which is distantly related. And when you do this kind of stuff, you know, some of this is from the literature, some of it is our own experimental infections. You see these, you know, X's meaning where they can't get infected, question marks, we don't know, a little frog meaning they could get infected. Okay? And you really don't see any kind of pattern. When you actually look at the ecology of these guys, the only thing that we can actually show that's similar among these different clades of frog lung flukes and the host they go into is the size of the frogs. Okay, so all of these generalists predominantly infect small to medium-sized frogs. okay? So do these basal ones. Most of the North American species that use strictly dragonflies as intermediate host predominantly infect bullfrogs and some of their relatives, except for one, this Medioplexus, which only infects leopard frogs, and it's a really goofy worm. Morphologically and physiologically, it's a really good species. In terms of this ITS stuff, it's only different by 4 base pairs, and that's why we get this really low bootstrap value, and we think maybe this was some recent host switch. But the reason that we think that this may be important, bullfrogs are relatively large frogs. This is a photograph of an average-sized bullfrog. So they're big frogs. They're one of the biggest frogs in the world. Okay, and because of that, they're big predators. This, I think I showed this before, emailed it to people. This is a bullfrog. This is its stomach, right? And this is what you find in it. So they can eat big things. Okay. Now, not all bullfrogs predominantly feed on mice, right, or voles in this case. But when we look at the size of the mouth of amphibians and the width, okay, of the or the length of the body, you see this, you know, nice correlation. Small frogs have a small mouth. Big frogs, like bullfrogs, have a big mouth. Okay, and if you look at the size of prey that frogs ingest. You also, there's not a lot of data for this. 3 of these points, I think, are mine, and 3 are from the literature. No one sits and measures what frogs eat out of their stomach. But you also see this nice correlation, and bullfrogs, on average, eat things that are about 30 millimeters in size. And the interesting thing is, most dragonflies, when they metamorphose, is when they're preyed upon by frogs, at least what's suggested in the literature. And those, on average, are about 30 millimeters. So potentially, you know, I don't know how to actually go about this, but there may be some, you know, selective pressure on bullfrogs feeding on organisms that are, on average, 30 millimeters in size, and dragonflies, at least in the larval stage, being that size, that actually selected these things to become specialists in dragonflies instead of some of these other hosts.
So that'd be 30
millimeters
in length. Right,
okay,
so kind of
the diameter. Yeah. And that's how actually all this stomach counting data was collected, to measure the length of these things. They argue that, you know, potentially if they eat them sideways or something. All right, so basically, you know, just looking at some of this stuff, our data on these Nebraska nematodes and trematode life cycles is starting to kind of give us a picture that these parasite species life cycles and our host's use really may vary, you know, depending on regional environment and the available definitive hosts. And it seems, at least from the little work that we have here, that these nematode life cycles are associated with a moist soil environment. And these species may actually switch hosts based on host ecology, even though some of those hosts are not as good as supposedly terrestrial toads may be. And then in trematode life cycles, this whole thing of the second intermediate host specificity may be really kind of important in these evolutionary lineages of frog trematodes. And I didn't go through the bladder fluke stuff, but we're starting to put together a bladder fluke phylogeny based on some sequences. And those may be a little bit more difficult to figure out what's going on because some of those life cycles are so plastic. And we really don't know if they were done correctly. And I think that's about it. I think I'm going to stop with this and not get to the peak points.
Okay, so the question about the Cosmos Cercordes thing. So that after a couple days, in the leopard frogs and things, they shed those worms if they get it eaten from other areas. So, I guess one thing you could do with that is just keep them in the lab for like a week, and so if there's any sort of incidental infection going on, they kind of clear it before you actually open them.
Yeah, but this is the leopard frogs will lose actually a lot of their parasites too in the
lab. So they lose everything.
Not everything, but they lose certain ones. And some of the problem with infecting Iran is, you know, I don't know if they just have a weak digestive system or they're temperamental. Those nematode infections and those things are hard to establish. And I think one of the only ways you can actually start addressing that stuff is doing some molecular stuff on populations of those and see how they're cycling. But you know, if you usually they will lose them, although some of them, you know, I managed to infect one or two that I kept around for 30 days or so, and they had worms in them.
So are the ones that are shed, are they infecting too?
Well, I could keep those worms alive in a petri dish in water for 3 weeks if the water's clean as adults.
So the ones that have gone through, the frogs are actually infected?
They could be, yeah, if they would go in.
No, I mean to another host.
No, they can't just burrow in. The problem is once they're adults, they can't do anything to get in.
Well, maybe another toad came along and happened to eat it somehow accidentally. I guess it could be.
But they're kind of cool worms because I think those are supposedly the most primitive ascarids. In all the ascarids, the Cosmosercoides and the Catalanidae, and I don't think anyone's ever sequenced any of those things to be able to see where they actually fit in some of those ascarid life cycles, which is kind of exciting. So
is there no way to kind of control for that? Say, well, these species are probably the result of accidental or they're not true hosts?
Well, no one's done any of this, you know, so one of Anderson's students, Baker initially did the life cycle of this one. It was called Cosmosercoides duque. There's another species that actually infects snails, and they think it was a host capture. And when frogs eat snails, they get these things. And the problem is that you can tell them apart by the number of rosette papillae on the caudal end. And duque has 12 on average, but it ranges from 8 to 20. Variabilis has 20 on average, but it ranges from 12 to 25. And for whatever reason, in iranas, you always find them, they have about 14 to 15. In toads, they have on the few that you look at and count these things, they usually have 18 to 20. And so one of the things for a while I was thinking, and you never see these kind of migrations that you see in toads where they go in the lungs and so on. One of the things I was thinking for a while that this may be just a different species, because initially they described the slug one from a newt because it ate it, and then they described another one because of some confusion, not checking stuff. And they fixed this stuff eventually. One of Anderson's students raise these things from slugs, which I can't raise for whatever reason. I kill all my slugs and the ones from toads, and you cross-infected them, and you can get them in both hosts, although the prevalence is really low from the wrong host. So in toads, the slug ones, maybe 10% could get infected. They never seem to mature. The ones from toads and slugs do the same thing.
So that, what were you feeding your slugs?
I by the time I even got to feeding them, it was too warm in those rooms, and they all kind of. But there's another cool snail, Xenotoides, which is one of these shelled snails that I've actually found a nice population where they're infected. That potentially may be easier to keep alive.
And then next week,
I don't know. Do we have a schedule?
I could talk about the tapeworm stuff if you guys want, since I kind of put some. There's some really cool life cycle tapeworm stuff.
You
want to
do tapeworms next week?
Sure.
Tell
them why don't I do the Oswaldo Cruz Institute next week? Just how long will your tapeworm take?
I could make it short. I could make it 15, 20
no,
minutes.
Why don't we do it? Let's stretch this out.
Okay.
Yes, you can have the whole hour next week.
I'll do next week.
Will you call Mindy and tell her your title?
Okay.
Thanks.
They have been mailed today.
Oh, the thing's already been mailed out for this week? It's okay.
You can get it next week.
No one else comes.
We were in this.
Yeah.
We went up in the...